Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin have just finished the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. Today, we're going to be talking about Africa. Austin, you wrote a piece recently on AFRICOM, the new command group down in, that's going to cover Africa. Africa is a hot spot for the future, but we haven't – I mean, the mainstream media has not covered it a lot. So what do you see coming up in Africa?
Well, Dan, look, Africa is a hot spot for the past, a hot spot for the present, and a hot spot for the future, in part because it is just riddled with, you can't begin to call them really failed states because they were imaginary states to begin with. Now, that's I don't want to, by any means, paint the entirety of Africa with the same brush. I do think that is something that major media it tends to do, particularly at the headline level or even at the neglect level, which is unfortunate because Africa has, it's a very complicated place. There are more ethnic groups there than any other continent on the planet. And why we can make that statement, to take a look at it from the African locals' perspective, how they see what we're calling tribes or even clans, they would see them as, well, they might see them as related clans or the like, but they see them, you know, ethnic terms. Just take an example, Rwanda, you know, Tutsis and Hutus, heavily intermarried, but Tutsis see themselves as one group, more Nilotic, Hutus, less Nilotic, more Bantu, and then you have the Twa, who are the Pygmies, who see themselves as the odd group out there in Rwanda. You also have the Twa show up in parts of Uganda as well. And then that's just a very crude breakdown, because there are clan and intra-tribal divisions as well. If I start telling I will go ahead and tell the story. At the time I spent in East Africa, for example, northern Uganda, it was primarily in Alor country, but I'd move from one village to another, and I would get what the people over there are like and where we were from, and then as you move on across the Congo border, there's still the Alor tribe spilling over the other side that they're referred to as their cousins. That's not the highly granular. That is the highly granular reality of Africa, but that's not the picture you get in the major media. Now, as for the issues, we cover Congo, we cover Ethiopia and Eritrea, we cover Somalia, occasionally Kenya. Certainly, we cover Rwanda and Burundi. You can still find material ongoing on Angola, the Central African Republic, Congo Brazzaville, Republic of Congo with the capital at Brazzaville, and then you'll see things show up occasionally in Tanzania, Mozambique, Madagascar, and a lot on Zimbabwe. It is every one of these collisions, every one of these vexing conflicts is unique in its own way. I should say, I think I mentioned Kenya. We do cover Kenya both in relationship to Somalia and Ethiopia, but also, for example, earlier this year, Kenya's own tribal-based and corruption-spurred conflict. There was a war over last year's presidential election. But every one of them is unique in its own terms. But let me give you some measures to look at it. With tribal divisions is one, and those are historical divisions. Rampant corruption, that's something that Jim Dunnigan writes about all the time, and as the plague of governments everywhere, but particularly the plague of governments in the developing world. It's our gang gets in power and our gang gets rich. That is something that afflicts Africa, undermines fostering economic recovery or economic creation in many of these places. Also, outside interests. Congo is a classic example of this. Outside interest in Congo's mineral wealth. Congo is absolutely blessed with an array of vital minerals. And so it's not just the mining companies that, in the past, mining company interests, European colonial powers in Congo interested in the minerals. But you have neighboring countries. Uganda was hit with a with accusation. I think it was, as I recall, it was proved as well that the Ugandan forces plundered between $5 and $10 billion, perhaps $12 billion worth of resources from northeastern Congo during the time that Ugandan forces were operating as notionally peacekeepers or in northeastern Congo. And I'm just blaming this on Uganda. Uganda and Congo have tried to deal with this at a diplomatic and political level. You see that same game being played throughout Africa. Recall in Angola's case, blood diamonds, and this also applied in Sierra Leone, as I recall, certainly in Congo and in Angola. But blood diamonds, the diamond trade, propping up some of the rebel movements. Oil in the case of not. Angola is a classic example of one of the reasons that Angola was a battlefield in the Cold War, primarily coming out of their Cabinda province, which leads to another component. Cabinda, is it logical that Cabinda would be part of Angola since it is separated by a slice of Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the Congo has the estuary Congo River and its ports. Some of the maps, it goes back to my earlier statement about it, imaginary countries. Well, they were drawn up in European conferences. They were drawn up in the case of Sudan with some degree of logic on the part of trying to separate potential opposition groups and other places. No logic whatsoever. However, the logic comes back to bite you, because really Sudan, in its case, you've got a northern Arabized, substantially Muslim section around Khartoum. And I say substantially Muslim. There are other faith groups in the area, and substantially Christian or animist in the south around Juba, where you have what we at Strategy Page have started calling the GOS, Government of South Sudan, actually picked up the acronym from a European source several years ago. Because I'd noticed and written about it for Strategy Page, how the Government of South Sudan was increasingly acting autonomously and more like a separate government. And we've got to step forward to the supposed vote that's coming in 2011 to decide whether that South Sudan is going to become more fully autonomous from the north. And then you have the hodgepodge war in Darfur, land of the fur, where these tribes, many of them Muslim, for the most part Muslim, but they're black African, and they've been plagued by mobile mounted raiders, at one time on camels and horses, now predominantly on horses or vehicles, spurred by, in this case, the controlling Islamist government in Khartoum. You've got those elements, which I've described in the case of Sudan, and then the ethnic and historical elements, religious sectarian collisions. Another major point here, a lot of that collision line runs right across from East Africa to West Africa, where Islam in conflict with Christianity is a component of it. Other things that we have written about at Strategy Page, environmental degradation is part of it. You see that in the Grand Sahel. Growing populations, even though there's some things going on about, I remember something actually Jim wrote almost 10 years ago about HIV and the fact of the number of HIV afflicting particularly sub-Saharan Africa, you've got the disease issue at the same time with people, more greater populations, and the populations are becoming more urban. Urbanization has become an affliction of sub-Saharan Africa. Slums of Nairobi, example, slums of Kinshasa. People have left the backcountry and moved to the cities, and the increase in ability to pass diseases has been literally part of the plague that these weak and poor governments must deal with.
Wow, that's a lot, Austin.
Well, I've given you a lot. Now, you asked me really about Africa, and that's kind of Austin Bay's quickie overview on sub-Saharan Africa. There are things that I know somebody can sit there and say, well, you missed this, you missed this. By darn, of course, or, you know, I disagree with some of the take on that. I've actually, and now let me back up on this. The first edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War came out in 1985. I received a note from a fellow who had been an editor at Arbor House and then was later moved to Atlantic Monthly Press, and I want to say it was about 1988 or 89. He sent me a note saying, hey, Austin, that book that you and Jim Dunnigan wrote, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, has been picked up by this Harvard conference on the third world, but as an example of understanding the tribal basis of a number of conflicts, particularly in Africa. And he had a photocopied a piece where they had were talking about the book. And how these things sometimes happen, I'm sitting there looking at that saying, hey, that's cool. And I happen to be reading something about U.S. diplomatic and military security efforts in Southern Africa, and it's when it first dawned on me that United States European Command was really running Africa as a subsidiary of theater. And I thought, you know, what that is at its basic level is it acts as a diplomatic, it's a diplomatic problem, because it basically says you're an afterthought. Well, now Africa, in the Cold War context, was certainly a diplomatic afterthought. But here it was in the way that the U.S. had structured its defense postures, and the way that the way theater commands work too. Or don't work, but often do work with the State Department, is that the military supplies the muscle for what the State Department does in many of these more remote areas. For instance, obviously the Air Force is flying diplomatic support missions so that you can keep our embassies running. And it's theater commands work, and I've seen them work better than they get credit for with the State Department, the State Department with the military. And I thought, well, you know, Africa is a place where you really could get some more close work with the State Department and Department of Defense. And you've seen, Dan, I write about this at Strategy Page all the time. I write about it in my newspaper column. I talk about it, the lack of achieving unified effects in American policy. We don't do diplomacy and military and economics and information intelligence together, the so-called dime. You know, we seem to be going in four ways at once. Well, an Africa command seemed to make sense to me, and it made more sense after I pulled a tour in 1995 at Southcom, when Southern Command was still in Panama, and Southern Command was working. It was an economy of force theater, secondary theater, but at the same time, a lot of this, more of this longer range kind of diplomatic and security cooperation was part and parcel of what their mission was. So I became an advocate for a separate African command. As I mentioned in the column I wrote this week, I had breakfast with a senior Army officer who was, he'd actually worked in diplomatic attaché slots in, military attaché slots in southern Africa, and it was in Washington, and he sat there and gave me, he says, you know, we try to do this, we try to do that, we have no money, we're short on personnel, and, even though we've got a number of very, very well-informed State Department officials, and certainly in the military and on the special operations side of the house, because they'd been doing so many military assistance group work throughout Africa, we just can't make much of an impact. And this was, I want to say, 92 or 93. I had breakfast with him. It was before Rwanda. And that was something that was certainly on my mind when Rwanda occurred. And then, like I said, a year after the Rwandan genocide in 94, 95, I was at Southcom saying, you know, the AFRICOM makes a lot of sense on part for American security and both, you know, let's say combining the diplomatic and military elements. 9/11, I think, is what makes AFRICOM possible, because now we realize that parts of the third world cannot be ignored, because guys like Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are not ignoring the third world. They're looking for failed states so that they can set up bases of operation.
Yes. Jim, one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that we've got a host of small units all over Africa.
These small units are generally training teams, but they're also, and I'm not giving anything away here, intelligence collection teams. The Special Forces has long been doing this. They've been doing it for actually over half a century. The Marines have been getting into it, and when there's been a huge demand for these training services, as there has been in Africa of late, we've even sent reservists. Who, you know, get debriefed after they've done it, but they're basically old enough and wise enough to impart the kind of training that African countries want. The problem with the training is that, and we learned this years ago in South America, is we just basically, well, in many cases, we just make a more effective secret police. The military in most African countries, and in many countries around the world, is not there to defend the country, but to control the country. The United States Army got a lot, it still gets a lot of criticism because they trained a lot of the armies in South America who subsequently turned into, you know, the people who were terrorizing their own population and basically being the secret police, as it were. But this was never the intention of the training, and it's always a risk you take when you do train the troops. I mean, ideally, you want to show soldiers how they can basically be civil servants and not civil oppressors. But as Austin points out, there are more powerful things at work in Africa, and it's mainly the tribalism. Many people will wave the national flag, they'll cheer if the national team wins at a football match. But still, when push comes to shove, the tribe comes first, family comes first. This is something most Americans just can't quite grasp because we are so far, you know, displaced from it. The closest we get to it, is perhaps, you know, Indian tribes and Mormons. Excuse me, you can take that one out. The closest thing we get to it is Indian tribes, and we regard them as alien. Some people, you know, might associate, you know, if they're very strongly religious, Amish, Hasidic, whatever, they may, you know, feel an enormous attachment, you know, to their church, as it were, their religious group. But that is nothing like what you encounter with your tribal-based societies in Africa, in Asia, in many parts of the world, even South America. This overwhelms everything. It fuels corruption. And basically anything you do to a member of the tribe is first of all an asset for the tribe. And this is something that the American troops, especially the special forces, are well aware of. And I've sat down and talked to some of these guys, and they just can't quite figure out a way to get around it. You know, other than perhaps this one guy jokingly, actually more than one guy jokingly said, help some of the brighter guys get green cards so they can go to America, get rich, and come back. Because basically a rich man in the tribe is de facto a tribal leader and can change things. But just the guy who's better at handling a gun, you know, he can just help defend the tribe. He doesn't have much to say about what direction the tribe is going to go in. The tribes do change. The thing, and anthropologists out there will understand this, with, you know, nearly 1,000, well, it's down to about 700 now. I mean, the tribal system is breaking down naturally, as it has in Europe over the last few hundred years. It generally disappeared. There's still a few left. But it takes a long time. But there's still 700 tribes, and there's an enormous variability in those tribes, as one could imagine. I mean, some of them you'd think, well, hey, this tribalism is a benefit. Some of the tribes, for example, are very commercial, are very progressive, so to speak. In other words, when they first encountered the Europeans after the shooting stopped, they said, gee, how can I learn to read? How can I basically get an education? Some tribes are considered natural traders. You know, they're always, you know, bartering or, you know, making money, in effect. And you'll find them, you go to a big country like Nigeria, and you'll find members of these trading, these entrepreneurial tribes all over the place running the stores. But there are many tribes that are just basically, you know, like the Taliban in Afghanistan, which is basically created by a few very conservative Pashtun tribes, are very tied to maintaining traditions. And you have a big problem in changing that quickly, because you not only have, it's not just the old-timers, but basically a lot of the young, the, you know, middle-aged people. In other words, a majority of the tribe has bought into this. And those who don't get along with it, you know, basically go. And nowadays, they can go. So basically, the tribes that are traditional are really hardcore, because anybody who wants to change looks around and says, you know, it's easier if I go to the city. As Austin mentioned, there's a huge problem with basically the more footloose members of the tribes going to the city. But if they get into big trouble, they'll always go home. But while they're in the city, they are changing. But the overall problem with Africa is the change is not coming that fast. The colonialism ended almost 50 years ago. And look at the mess, you know, the continent is still in, and it's still because of the tribalism. It's going to take another 50 years or more before you're going to change a lot of those attitudes. And in the meantime, we have to worry about, you know, Islamic terrorists setting up shop in some of the failed states. By the way, I should mention, the reason Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorist groups have not been able to successfully establish, you know, terrorist bases, as it were, in Africa, is because of the other problems Africa has, the lack of infrastructure and the tribalism. The tribes will turn on someone who is seen as a, you know, a foreign, alien, malevolent, you know, presence. The Arabs are not liked in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's why, as any reader of Strategy Page knows, we describe in great detail the problems in Sudan, Chad, in Nigeria, but especially in the north, in Somalia, between Somalia and Kenya. For thousands of years, the Arabs have been basically beating on, you know, the sub-Saharan, you know, the black Africans, as it were, and that, the depth of that hatred on either side, well, the Arabs basically despise the Africans, and the Africans hate, you know, the Arabs for all the harm they've done to them and keep doing to them. This makes it very difficult for an Arab, basically an Arab terrorist organization, to set up shop in sub-Saharan Africa. They tried in North Africa, you know, other parts of Africa, which are basically Arab states, and they have failed for other reasons, for the violence and what have you. But they really can't set up, you know, an effective base, as it were, as they did in Afghanistan, or they're doing now in Pakistan, simply because there's no there. They tried it in Somalia, and you can't operate in Somalia. Somalia, it's a struggle just to stay alive if you're living there, and that's basically what the Islam, and there are some Islamic terrorists, you know, hiding out in Somalia, but they can't operate. It's hard to get out of there. And of course, we've got 1,000, you know, American and French special operations forces up in Djibouti, keeping an eye on the place. So Africa has its pluses and minuses, but I'd say overall, it's more of a minus for the terrorists than it is for the people who are chasing the terrorists.
What about the piracy that's happening off the Horn of Africa?
Piracy has been a problem in that part of the world for thousands of years. It's very simple, the situation that's going on there. As we explained in Strategy Page, the traditional solution for the piracy was for the ships, whether they be, you know, 1,000 years ago, just a shipload of, soldiers, come aboard, kill everybody they can catch, burn all everything down they can set fire to, and then later on the British, you know, came along with their sailing ships and basically bombarded the villages, destroyed everything, sent some people ashore to burn everything, and then go off. The message was, if you keep, you know, up with the piracy, we will keep destroying your villages. And that works. That will keep it down. Up to a point. You got to keep reapplying the rule, but after a couple of years, they forget and say, hey, look at all those rich ships out there. Let's go grab a few. Times have changed. You can't do that anymore. I mean, if you go ashore, your journalists are going to be, you know, hanging about. If you kill civilians, you know, it's war crimes time. You simply can't do that. Now, that can change because the Russians have a ship on the way. The French have already used their commandos to attack the pirates, at least enough to get their French citizens, you know, who were captured, you know, out of harm's way. But basically the solution is you have probably a dozen or more fishing villages. You have, 20,000-30,000 maybe, I'm estimating here, civilians who are basically living large. I mean, they're the ones the pirates spend their money on. And then you only have a few thousand actual, you know, former fishermen or part-time, you know, pirates, and part-time fishermen who were out there running around in these speedboats, which were bought with first warlord money. And now with these millions of dollars in ransom, they're pulling about 30 million, you know, several million dollars a month in ransoms out of the insurance companies, maritime insurance companies. They're going to keep going at it, until the traditional solution is applied, because there's nobody to negotiate with. You're dealing with over a dozen different entities, and if you take away one or two of them, there's always going to be guys coming at the request, because the word is all over Somalia. This is the Klondike. You know, this is the mother lode. You want to get rich? Just run around in a boat with your AK-47 and jump on one of these ships. It's like chasing whales. They look at it as a big game.
And if you're really lucky, you'll get a boat full of tanks.
Well, you know, that was more funny than anything else. Yeah. There's nothing they could do with the tanks because the boat was what they call a roll-on, roll-off boat. So they needed a particular kind of dock to put them to. And that's one reason why American warships quickly surrounded, you know, basically put themselves in front of the ship. They didn't want it the pirates to possibly take that ship to any, you know, port, maybe in Yemen. I think there's one or two they could possibly roll the tanks off in Somalia on the east coast, not on the north coast where they are. So we've stopped. So basically they can get some of the small arms off. But most of the 23, I think, 100 tons of munitions, most of it is those 33 tanks. But what some pirates realized right away was, hey, we can get more ransom for this. But the insurance companies play hardball. And what the insurance companies are apparently doing is waiting for the Russians to show up. Now, the Russians, interestingly enough, are taking their time. The ship that was sent from the Baltic Fleet, actually, the ship left the day before the Ukrainian freighter got taken. The ship was being sent anyway. It was a frigate, a 4,000-ton, you know, warship, being sent anyway to join the International Anti-Piracy Patrol, Task Force 150 in the Gulf of Aden. When the Ukrainian ship was taken a few days later, the Russians announced, we have a ship on the way. They had mentioned that it had left before the piracy event took place. But the ship is following its original itinerary, which includes a port call in Libya, along with the battle cruiser Peter the Great, which is then going to proceed on to Venezuela. And it looks like, you know, this Russian frigate is not going to arrive off the north coast of Somalia until the middle of October, you know, for another week perhaps. But what the insurance companies are doing is say, when the Russians get here, they're not like everybody else. They don't play by the rules. And so far that's worked. They've gotten the ransom, down to 8 million. I think they're shooting for 2. But eventually, I mean, the pirates know how the game is played, and they basically know that they're in effect taxing every ship that goes through the Gulf of Aden. There's 20,000 a year. Because all the insurance companies have done is they've raised the rates. They've gone from about $900, you know, that's what normally it would cost for the, you know, the going through the Gulf of Aden, so to speak. I mean, they have a complicated formula for, you know, what it costs, what the maritime insurance, depending on where your, where your ship is going to be, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, it used to cost about $900 to pass through the, Gulf of Aden. Now it's close to $10,000. And it'll keep going up. And that money, the insurance company, they take their cut, and they just negotiate the ransom, and they just pass it on to the pirates. So the pirates are basically, you know, running an extortion scam on every ship that passes through the Gulf of Aden. Now that can go on indefinitely, because it's increasing the, like, it costs the ship, for example, several hundred thousand dollars in fees to go through the Suez Canal. So put it in perspective. It's a cost, but it's not breaking the bank.
Yeah.
And some of the pirates understand this. I mean, the guys in charge, because they have negotiators from the Persian Gulf. There's plenty of wheeler dealers up there, and several of them have quickly jumped on this. And they basically ransom brokers. And they explain it to them. And so, you know, as far as the pirates are concerned, as long as we keep our video cameras nearby and our speed dial for all the, for CNN and all the media, we're fairly safe. But that could change. I mean, somebody could decide, all right, it's time to go old school on these guys. And the piracy gets shut down. But that's the only way you're going to shut it down. You got to go ashore, and nobody really wants to go ashore in Somalia. So there it is.
Well, it sounds like it's their version of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Exactly, except theirs isn't over. Theirs can go on indefinitely.
Right. All right, well, that wraps us up for today. Thanks, Jim.
My pleasure.